Ceasefire negotiations are ongoing in Qatar.
We have yet to see a very clear position from the Israeli government towards these principles laid out by President Biden.
Plus, what does Beijing think of a second Trump presidency?
For the Chinese government and the Chinese government officials who had to work on anything related to the United States during the first Trump term, honestly, they're all traumatized in every single way by that 4 years of experience. There were so many things that were out of ordinary.
And later, an Israeli high school forced to move south, and Volodymyr Zelensky is in Asia. Today is Tuesday, June 4th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Ceasefire negotiations are ongoing in an attempt to stop the fighting between Israel and Hamas. As we've reported here before, President Joe Biden is encouraging both sides to accept the deal currently on the table. Qatar has been mediating the talks.
It is something that we are working with both sides right now, and we are using our leverage as a mediator, meaning in the mediation, on the mediation table itself, to make sure that both sides understand the gravity of the situation and the need to reach an agreement.
That's Qatari Foreign Minister Majed Al Ansari.
And as I said, we have yet to see a very clear position from the Israeli government towards these principles laid out by President Biden, and that would translate to the other side. We are looking now into concrete answers from both sides over their current suggestions, and we're hopeful that we can get them.
Volker Turk is the UN's High Commissioner for Human Rights. He also is expressing his hope that an end to the fighting can come soon.
Any initiative that leads to a ceasefire, that leads to an ending of what's happening now, is of course welcome. We can only hope that that is achieved, because the humanitarian situation bears words. We don't even know how to describe it anymore. It is beyond precarious. It is beyond catastrophic.
Meanwhile, in addition to fighting against Hamas in the south, Israel faces a threat from Hezbollah in the north. Like Hamas, Hezbollah is supported by Iran and seeks to eliminate the state of Israel. Both groups have been classified as terrorist organizations by the U.S. and other Western governments. But while Hamas was in control of Gaza, Hezbollah exists inside Lebanon. Following October 7th, Hezbollah fired missiles into northern Israeli towns and villages, forcing mass evacuations. Reuters' Zachary Goldman has the story of a high school that was forced to relocate to Tel Aviv.
Just north of Tel Aviv, an office building that sits atop a movie theater and shopping mall has been converted into classrooms. These students aren't from around here. They're from the city of Kiryat Shmona, on the border with Lebanon. They are among the 60,000 Israelis relocated from northern Israel since October 7th. Ofer Zafrani is the principal of Kiryat Shmona's Danziger High School.
We built here a school. We do here everything, everything. They study everything. We try to give them whatever we can. But still, it's not their home. They are far away from home. Many of them are very sad. They want to go back.
But they can't go back, at least right now. This was the scene last month after rockets launched by the Lebanese Hezbollah militant group struck Kiryat Shmona. Hezbollah and Israeli forces have traded fire since the start of the Gaza war. Israel has said the rocket fire, which prompted the mass relocations, is untenable and warned it could escalate its military operation in the north. Among those relocated, 14,600 are children, scattered in temporary kindergartens and schools, or premises repurposed as makeshift daycares or classrooms. Teachers told Reuters the strain of the relocations is being felt by students. According to the Israeli Education Ministry, high school dropout rates for pupils from the north can reach 5%, around double the national average. Roni Hotam is 17 years old.
This is not my school, this is not my home, and it's really scary, and I'm really sad and upset about it, but I'm trying to stay positive as much as I can. I'm trying to survive every day, face the reality.
Now, with this school year winding down, educators, students, and parents are wondering if the next year will begin in hometowns, temporary classrooms, or bomb shelters. David Dub is an English teacher.
I am really skeptical about us going back on by the 1st of September. Saying that, we're all very optimistic here. We're doing our best to give what we can to the students and to ourselves. And that's the way it is at the moment.
The big unknown remains whether or not things will cool down or heat up. Yoav Kish is the country's education minister and a member of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's Likud party.
It's obvious to us that if there'll be a full-scale war with the North, with Hezbollah, we'll have to change the education system in the sense of maintaining safe locations for study, and most of Israel will be under fire, and it's a different issue than just what we have right now, which is only the northern border, which is suffering from that.
The exchanges of fire on Israel's northern front have so far been contained without escalating into an all-out cross-border war in Lebanon, but scores of people have been killed on both sides.
That's Reuters' Zachary Goldman reporting. And also to Israel's north, a senior advisor from Iran's Revolutionary Guard was among 16 people killed in an Israeli airstrike on Monday in the western part of Syria's Aleppo province. Turning our attention now to the war in Ukraine, we get a frontline update and a look at President Zelensky's trip to Asia and news about an upcoming peace summit in Switzerland. VOA's Anna Chernikova reports from Kyiv.
Before dawn on Tuesday morning, Russian forces launched a missile attack on the city of Dnipro and the Dnipropetrovsk region. As a result of falling debris, 8 people, including 2 children, were injured, and civil infrastructure, private buildings, and a hospital were damaged. In their latest report, the Institute for the Study of War confirms that Russian forces advanced north of the city of Kharkiv in the Lipetsk direction. According to Institute for the Study of War, Ukrainian forces recently regained limited positions within Vovchansk, northeast of Kharkiv, amid continued fighting in and around the city. At the same time, Russian forces continue actions in the Donetsk region, creating additional challenges to the Ukrainian forces as they are lacking prepared manpower. Experts and Ukrainian military officials believe that Russian forces are preparing for a new big offensive in the south and are trying to exhaust and disrupt Ukrainian forces with active hostilities in the Kharkiv and Donetsk regions using their superiority in manpower and weapons. Meanwhile, the White House confirms that President Joe Biden will not take part in the Global Peace Summit in Switzerland on June 15th and 16th. Vice President Kamala Harris and National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan will represent the United States instead. Until the last moment, Ukraine hoped President Biden would participate in the summit. Reaction to the news inside the country is subdued. Many took it negatively, emphasizing the weakened level of the summit in the absence of the U.S. president. Others note that in any case, the U.S. will be represented at a very high level. President Volodymyr Zelensky previously claimed that Vladimir Putin would be comforted by Biden's absence from the summit in Switzerland. Later, the Ukrainian president, commenting on China's refusal to participate in the summit, said that the U.S. would be represented at the summit at a high level, while China would play along with Russia and refuse other countries to participate in the summit. As a part of the preparation for the peace summit and strengthening of Ukraine's support in the region, President Volodymyr Zelensky visited Singapore and the Philippines. In Singapore, Zelensky met with the president and prime minister. The leaders discussed the prospects for deepening bilateral relations and expanding trade, increasing the export of agricultural products. In the Philippines, Zelensky met with the President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. for the first time in the history of bilateral relations.
And we are very thankful to be in your country, and which supports Ukraine, our territorial integrity and sovereignty. Thank you so much for your big word and clear position about us.
The leaders also discussed bilateral cooperation, in particular the export of Ukrainian agricultural products to the Philippines and the Global Peace Summit, in which the Philippines has already confirmed participation. Zelensky also announced that Ukraine intends to open an embassy in Manila this year to strengthen bilateral cooperation. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. What are Beijing's hopes and expectations for the upcoming American elections? We'll have that conversation in a few minutes. First, though, elsewhere in Asia, South Korea says it will fully resume military activities along its tense border with North Korea. The move is part of South Korea's response to the North sending hundreds of balloons filled with garbage into the South. More from VOA's Bill Gallo in Seoul.
South Korea's military has found about 1,000 North Korean balloons, which dropped trash and reportedly feces across the country. On Tuesday, South Korea announced part of its response.
우리 정부는 오늘 국무회의 의결과 대통령 재가를 거쳐
South Korean Defense Ministry official Cho Chang-rae said the government has decided to fully suspend a military agreement meant to reduce tensions with the North. The decision frees South Korea to resume military drills along the border. It also allows for the resumption of loudspeaker propaganda broadcasts into the North. North Korea says its trash balloons were retaliation after a South Korea-based human rights activist sent anti-regime pamphlets northward. It says the trash balloons will stop as soon as the leaflet campaign stop. That appears unlikely, since the South Korean activist sending the pamphlets has demanded a personal apology from Kim Jong-un. The moves put the two Koreas on a path to further escalations. That is according to Seoul-based analyst Chad O'Carroll, who said North Korea appears determined to stop the infiltration of outside information.
It's like a cancer, and it's a serious Achilles heel for Kim Jong-un, and they seem to be getting more and more sensitive about outside information going into North Korea. And I think this latest action is a function of that hypersensitivity around external information coming in.
North Korea is governed by a third-generation hereditary dictatorship, which views virtually all outside information as an existential threat. It would likely react firmly to any South Korean move to restore propaganda broadcasts, said O'Carroll.
If they do that, we could see a greater chance for North Korea to consider some limited form of kinetic military action to stop loudspeakers or to stop the growth of this unofficial information coming into the North.
In 2015, North Korea fired a projectile toward a South Korean loudspeaker. 3 years later, the two sides signed an agreement to stop the broadcasts and other border provocations. The deal has been eroding for years as North Korea escalated its military actions. After South Korea's decision on Tuesday, the agreement appears officially dead. What comes next is unclear. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul, South Korea.
As Americans prepare for the upcoming presidential election, people and governments all over the world are also preparing for an American presidential election. So what are Beijing's hopes and expectations? I speak with Sun Yun of the Brookings Institution for some context.
I think they're concerned with the unpredictability, the uncertainty, and also the expected increased volatility of U.S.-China relations if Trump wins the election. Because I think for the Chinese government and the Chinese government officials who had to work on anything related to the United States during the first Trump term, honestly, they're all traumatized in every single way by that 4 years of experience. There were so many things that were out of ordinary. If you look at the general pattern of U.S.-China relationship between President Trump had so many moves that the Chinese were not expecting. He has a maximum pressure campaign. The Chinese at first thought that, well, if Trump likes to deal, great. We love transactions. We're Chinese, right? But when they realize that Trump's deals is usually preceded or Trump usually start with a maximum pressure campaign before he makes any deals, that's something the Chinese were not anticipating. So they're following his campaign rhetoric very closely, trying to watch very carefully what he vows to do. So they're making notes of all the little things that he says related to China, related to Taiwan, and try to prepare for the tremendous volatility in the U.S.-China relations if he does win.
So is it safe to say then that the Chinese would prefer Biden?
Well, if you ask the Chinese, I think they will say that both Trump and Biden are bad. Because under the Biden administration, they realized that, yes, it has been more stable. The risk of war has been significantly reduced under President Biden. But they also realize that Biden has been extremely effective in his competition strategy with China. He has been extremely successful in building and strengthening alliances, partnerships, and coalitions vis-a-vis China, not only regionally, but globally. So using the word-by-word quote from a Chinese strategist, both Trump and Biden are poison for China. But if they look at the potential for war and the extreme volatility, remember, Beijing has almost a natural preference, a tendency to prefer stability. They like transactions. They like competing under the table. They like those underhanded little moves. But they don't like direct confrontation, which leaves them very little room for maneuver. So in that sense, I think they prefer Biden because it offers more stability under which that they can compete with U.S.
If Trump were to win, can we expect Beijing to take any proactive actions to blunt any moves he might make?
I think it will be very hard. That's something the Chinese have been grappling with since the first Trump term. That what are the effective strategies to deal with Trump, knowing that he is volatile, knowing that he's unpredictable. And honestly, I feel the Chinese just shut down. That by 2020, they realized that China did not have effective tools, whether it is trade or diplomacy or security. There was very little that they could do to effectively counter or change the policy course of the United States. Remember, in the past, the Chinese were always willing to use transactionality, meaning that, well, if U.S. wants Chinese cooperation on this, the U.S. will have to deliver something in return. But under Trump, the Chinese found completely at loss that Trump did not accept that transactionality of the relationship. The Trump term or the Trump presidency was willing not to pursue cooperation with China simply for the sake of not giving China that advantage over the United States. So I have to say that part of the Chinese almost a sense of powerlessness coming to President Trump or a potential second term by Trump is almost a defining characteristics of how the Chinese are feeling when they look at the election of the United States this year. They're seeing this going in a dangerous direction. They're not able to stop it. They feel that anything they do to interfere or to influence U.S. election will be scrutinized and will be singled out, and they will end up at a worse place. And when they think about the unpredictability of Trump's policy down the road, they are bracing for impact.
Yun Sun is a non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution. Ms. Sun, thank you very much for your analysis this morning.
Thank you, Steve.
Tuesday marks the 35th anniversary of the June 4th, 1989 Tiananmen crackdown in Beijing, in which hundreds of people were killed by the Chinese military. In Hong Kong, in a sign that things have definitely changed, there are no large-scale public commemorations expected, as the city's decades-old annual vigil has stopped under the shadow of a new national security law imposed by Beijing in 2020. Hong Kong's leader, John Lee, avoided directly answering questions about it.
The government position on public events is very clear. All activities by any person must be conducted according to the law. No activities that contravene the law should take place. The government, of course, will take action in accordance with the law, which includes the public order ordinance, the Hong Kong national security law, and the safeguarding Hong Kong security ordinance.
Hong Kong authorities plan a massive police presence on the streets around the park where the vigil used to take place. And like last year, there will be a carnival put on by pro-Beijing groups. And now combining the war in Ukraine with Asia-Pacific security and trade, Oksana Beditenko of VOA's Ukrainian service spoke with Deputy Secretary of Treasury Wally Adeyemo over Zoom about his visit to Kyiv last week.
Last week, you've been to Europe and you talked about China's role in supporting Russia. Do you think European countries are ready to pose the choice in front of China, whether China will work with their economies or supply dual-use goods to Russia?
What we know for certain is that Russia is only able to build the weapons at scale they need for their war of choice in Ukraine because of goods that are coming from China. Ultimately, China needs to stop supplying Russia with this limited number of goods. And we're not talking about cutting off all trade between Russia and China. What we're saying is that China should not provide Russia with engines for their drones or small microelectronics that are powering their missiles and other goods that are critical to Russia's war machine. And in my conversations with our European allies and partners, we had a conversation about how we do that. And one of the most important things we can do is make sure that the United States, Europe, and all of Ukraine's allies are sending the same message to China that it's unacceptable for them to power Russia's war machine. And that ultimately the companies and individuals in China who are selling these goods to Russia have a choice. They can do business with our alliance, which represents 50% of the global economy, or they can continue to do business with Russia's military-industrial complex. They can't do both. And my view is that our allies, including Europe, we need to be committed to taking action if our words don't work to convince the Chinese to stop doing this behavior.
So how European countries responded? Were they receptive to your messages?
So after leaving Ukraine, I went to Germany and I gave a speech, not to a German think tank, but in front of the German business community, to make the case that this type of approach, where we deliver a strong, clear message to Russia and to China about the need to stop providing Russia with these goods, wasn't only in our national security interest, but was also fundamentally in all of our economic interests, because the last thing any of us want is a Russian military that is rebuilt and not only presenting a threat to Ukraine, but presenting a threat to NATO and to all of our national security. And my view is that our European allies and partners are committed to doing whatever it takes to make sure that Russia doesn't have access to these goods. And I expect that over the coming weeks and months, we will act together to make sure that we both provide Ukraine with the weapons you need and the money you need to continue to defend yourselves, but also to make sure that Russia has less access to the goods they need for the weapons they want for the war in Ukraine.
On the Russian frozen assets, there will be a G7 summit in June. Do you think the countries will agree to U.S. proposal to issue a loan to Ukraine using these assets?
So as you mentioned, the G7 leaders will be meeting in 2 weeks in Italy. But just a few weeks ago, Secretary Yellen and the G7 finance ministers met together and they discussed this specific topic. What can we do to make sure that we unlock the value of Russia's frozen assets for the benefit of the Ukrainian people? And they talked through a number of options that will allow us to make sure that Ukraine has access to the money you need to not only invest in your economy, but to invest in your defense. And my expectation is that as we get to the leaders' meeting, those leaders are going to endorse some of those options that will put us in a position where Ukraine will have access to the money you need to continue to defend yourselves. And Russia will know that they can't wait us out, that ultimately you will have the resources to defend yourself. And part of those resources should be resources that come from unlocking the value of Russia's sovereign assets.
That's Oksana Beditenko of VOA's Ukrainian service. She was speaking with Deputy Secretary of Treasury Wally Adiemo. And finally, today in Pakistan, former Prime Minister Imran Khan has been acquitted by a high court of charges of leaking state secrets. This according to his lawyer and his party. He will, however, remain in prison for now due to a conviction in another case. Khan has been at odds with the country's powerful military, accusing it of targeting him and his party. And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.